Ivor Gurney is not known as a composer of chamber music. His songs are famed, and with justification, they are among the finest examples of the genre ever written. But although he left a substantial body of works for instrumental ensembles, these have not yet entered the repertoire. Indeed, many of them were never published, and the manuscripts remain archived. However, this situation is now changing. Over the past couple of years, there has been a resurgence of interest in Gurney's instrumental music, with several works being examined, reassessed, performed, and recorded, and the violin sonata in E-flat, recorded by myself and the pianist Matthew Rickard for EM Records, is a particularly striking example of his contribution to the genre. It is by no means the only work of this type that Gurney composed. In fact, there exist over 18 sonatas for violin and piano in manuscript form, although the majority are incomplete. This example, though, was completed, and evidently completed fluently. Certainly, it is a highly successful composition, both in terms of its formal structure, its melodic characteristics, and its harmonic craftsmanship, and also in terms of the emotional impact it makes upon listeners. The sonata in E-flat belongs to a period in Gurney's life that was notable for the fact of his relative stability and contentment. Admittedly, it was begun in the Knapsbury War Hospital in St. Albans, whence Gurney had been invalided from the trenches of the First World War, but, as he wrote to Marion Scott, his champion and confidant, he had his hopes of a cathedral to look at through the window realised. Possibly he found the sight of St. Albans Abbey reassuring, a symbol of permanence and constancy, so different to the brutal chaos he had left in France. At any rate, what became the scherzo of the sonata was begun on the 24th of August 1918, being completed by the 7th of September. A few days later, on the 11th of September, Gurney began work on the first movement. Both these movements were revised in 1919. By this time, Gurney had renewed his composition studies at the Royal College of Music in London, where his tutor was Ralph Vaughan Williams, and whom Gurney found much more amenable and constructive in criticism than the famously acerbic and forthright Charles Villiers Stanford, with whom he had studied during his pre-war sojourn at the RCM. This was, in fact, a highly enjoyable period. Not only was he studying with a sympathetic and encouraging teacher, but he was also surrounded by like-minded and supportive friends, and living and working in a stimulating and vivifying environment. Small wonder, perhaps, that he was at last able to bring to completion a work on a scale and in a genre which he had always found more troublesome than the songs that came so readily and fluently from his pen. The sonata is, by any standards, a large-scale work. Cast in four movements, its coherence is, nevertheless, ensured by its high degree of internal unification. One of the clearest examples of this characteristic lies in the tonal relationships of the sonata's individual movements. The work's given key of E-flat major is balanced by the central movement's tonalities, which are positioned a third above and below this key. The scherzo, the second movement, is in G major, and the third movement is in C minor. The tonic notes of the three keys involved, C, E-flat, and G, spell out a C minor triad, and this key persistently manifests itself on smaller scales within the work. It occurs, for instance, in the middle section of the scherzo. And is hinted in the opening movement by the violin's prominent B natural at its very first entry. The scherzo, despite its central C minor section, has an overall mood of carefree light-heartedness. For much of the movement, the violin plays pizzicato, which imparts something of a folk-like character. And this underpins a simple and charming song-like melody in the piano. There is something of an Elgarian flavour, too, to the movement's closing bars. They have an ease, a gently idyllic quality that bespeaks relaxed contentment. It would be a mistake, however, to think that the sonata is entirely light-hearted. Turbulence and anguish are present too, especially in the third movement, which in many respects is the emotional core of the work. The writing in this lento is often strongly dissonant, and there is in much of the music a sense of rhythmic striving. Quavers become triplets, which in turn become semiquavers, almost as if an inner pressure is causing the music to break its bounds. We know from his letters and poetry that a sense of internal pressure, internal conflict, was one that Gurney experienced often. Although happy in London, he never ceased yearning for his beloved Gloucestershire countryside, for the Cotswold hills in which he walked sometimes for hours, for the bracing air of Crickley, and for the golden sunlight on the River Severn, images that were so essential to him that he felt them to be part of his very being. He writes the undulations of the hills into the long melodic lines of his sonata, and there is an especially striking moment towards the end of the fourth movement when he appears to see his native county from afar. At this point, the offbeat rhythms that have been a feature of the entire movement settle into a chorale-like texture in the piano, above which the violin sings a melodic line which is contented in its restraint, a remarkable contrast to the earlier, wide-ranging and more overtly dramatic melodic lines. It is significant, too, that in a work that is notable for its chromaticism and, at times, unorthodox juxtapositions of tonal areas, the last 10 bars are entirely diatonic. Gurney has returned home.